Does anyone have any comments to make about that, or questions, or have a start a discussion?
I just have a question. Is it always the way you do the progression of that from the most loving person to the to all state, all being? I mean, is that always the way it should be?
Well, that's the traditional formula, and I mean, there's so many variations of that that I've heard over the years, and one of the books I brought is Sharon Salzberg's Loving Kindness, and she has several different ways of doing the loving kindness, and she's written, you know, dozens of books at this point on loving kindness that has, you know, many meditations. So that's the formula that's been used these 2.5 millennia, and works well for a lot of people. It doesn't work for everyone, but I think the logic behind it is, you know, as I was mentioning earlier, really have to develop a sense of loving kindness for ourselves, or, you know, we get stuck there otherwise, and it's really hard to generate loving kindness for others if, you know, if we have a lot of self-incrimination, or, you know, poor self-esteem, or, you know, just a lot of negativity towards the self. And then it's easier to go on to somebody who we have a lot of regard for, and then, you know, going down the list to someone who we're less connected to, and then someone who we actually struggle with is very difficult, and it's not recommended in the beginning, because, you know, and this still happens to me sometimes, like, you know, the mind just goes off into the stories, you know, you can't be with the feelings and the heart. It's just like, you know, he said, she said, you know, I should have, why didn't, and, you know, and all of that stuff. So that's very difficult to work with the difficult person. And then ideally, we were talking about breaking down the barriers. We want to have loving kindness towards all beings equally. So that's why we end in that, or that's the ultimate. And sometimes it's taught where you just develop it towards people in the room you're with, and then the next category was people in the town, or your continent, or to all animals. So there's a lot of different variations, but this is kind of the standard formula that's still, you know, pretty common in insight meditation practice.
The attachment to happiness. I mean, there's, you know, aversion against depression or unhappiness. So anyway, talk a little bit about keeping that balance so it's not attachment, grasping happiness.
So you mean when you say the phrases and you wish for yourself or someone to be happy, how to not get caught up in that and really want that, grasp at it? Well, that's a good question. I mean, that's the challenge, you know, to do that. And I think what happens over time, at least what I've experienced, is that I can realize that, you know, my happiness is dependent on a lot of conditions. And some of those I have some control over, and some of them I don't. And, you know, I think you're pointing to something really important about the practice, you know, especially also you can say this with help, you know, maybe healthy. Mm-hmm. Can I be healthy? Is we don't have a lot of control over those things, and so it's real easy to, you know, I mentioned, I think this word supplicating prayer, or in, you know, another term is intercessional prayer, where you're actually trying to make an effect in the external world, or in your body and mind in a particular way. And there's grasping in that. There can be, maybe it can be done without it. I don't know. I haven't experienced that, you know, wanting myself, for example, to be healthy, and really, you know, being stuck on the outcome. So, you know, I had open heart surgery about 8 months ago, and I did a lot of loving kindness, you know. I didn't have a lot of fear going into it. Earlier, you know, in my life, whenever I was facing a medical crisis, I would you know, really contract around the fear and all of that. And I had, you know, so it wasn't an emergency. It was, you know, it was a condition that was, this open heart surgery was a condition I knew about for a long time. And so I had, you know, months to prepare for this and make some arrangements. And you know, I would just see, sometimes the fear would come up and I'd see the suffering in that, and I would just kind of feel that, and it would just usually dissipate. And then when I did the loving kindness phrases, a lot of times I would find myself, you know, going from being kind of neutral and having loving kindness to really, God, I really hope this surgery comes out well, you know, and I don't suffer and I don't die and, you know, all of this. And, you know, that's okay, but I could really at times see that difference, you know, between really wanting a certain outcome, you know, my success in this experience, and just, you know, being there with the feelings and generating the loving kindness. It really became, you know, having something really concrete like that really made it more tangible for me. And, you know, and then I don't know about this whole external effects of prayers. There were a lot of people saying loving kindness for me, and it was wonderful, you know, really warmed my heart to know that. And maybe, you know, maybe it had some other effect. I don't know. There's actually been some psychological studies looking at that. I guess the technical term is intercessional prayer and how what effect it has. And I haven't read those studies, but I've been told by some people that there is an effect, you know, that a reproducible, statistically significant effect. But that I think if we get caught up in wanting that outcome, it defeats the purpose of the loving kindness.
I do notice a kind of groundedness and clarity. I kind of feel it each time I practice loving kindness, but this session, it really felt grounded and clear. So, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Sometimes what I've found that's helpful for me in this thing of the breaking the barriers is to really focus on just as I would like to be happy, I wish for this other to be happy. So that you start to see that those conditions, you know, other people would like to also be happy, would also like to be healthy. And so it creates, instead of having a sense of this other, that this person comes into your circle. And so just as I would like to be happy, I would like for this other person to be happy. Or just as this other person would like to be happy, it's just like the same wish that I have for myself to be happy. And so it drops that barrier of having that person be different.
I've had a recent experience with finding loving compassion for a very difficult person, and it happened to be a family member who I grew up with but was never really close to, and now he's suffering from a mental illness, and my sister and I are visiting him. And what I found is that when I changed how I thought about him, I used to think he was just obnoxious and irritating and difficult, but when I could look at him as ill and a suffering human being, when I changed how I thought, I changed how I felt about him. And when I changed how I felt about him, I changed how I acted towards him. And that when I was leaving, and I don't remember ever hugging this person. And I remember telling him I wanted a hug. And he looked at me like I had, you know, like I was speaking a foreign language. And I said, I really don't want to leave until I have a hug. And so he kind of, you know, gave me a hug. And the next time I said it again, and I said, I love you. I have never said, I love you to this person. And the next time I gave him a kiss on the cheek. And it was all because I changed what was up here. And I am totally and really feel love right now. Mm-hmm. And he's I didn't really think that he knew that he was mentally ill, but he does, which was really kind of an eye-opener, too. I mean, I'm really seeing him on a whole different level, you know, and it's really that being kind of loving to a difficult person, it just, when you were talking about that, it just brought that, because he's... I always felt him as a typical person, and now I know. I feel better. I don't know how he feels.
Wow, that's terrific. That's quite a transformation. We'll have more time to talk about this stuff. Maybe we should just stand for a moment before we go on to some service and stretch. And so we're not sitting here for too long. So before lunch, we'll talk a little bit about service. That's the theme of the day long, and I've heard some people discuss this already. But I'd like to just kind of throw it out to you. What is service, or how would you define it, or what? You don't have to talk about specific types, but you know, what does service mean to you?
Being there for other people. I mean, in a place where you can help them do whatever needs to be done in a way that's kind in line.
Thank you. Yes?
One of the things that John Kabat-Zinn talks about in regards to service is to come from a place of humility and not knowing and bearing witness, because life is a mystery and we really don't have the answers. So to just open our hearts and be there, I think that it takes really being mindful of your own motivations to be there with that.
Great.
Being present for the needs and the needs of others, and for oneself.
I'm glad you added that last part, because that, you know, sometimes we can.
Yeah.
Think of service as only of serving others, but getting back to the loving kindness, you know, that we can't really serve others if we're totally neglecting ourselves. Or we can serve them, but a lot of times it's not always helpful when we're really that out of balance.
I think service is letting go, and that the person who offers the service to another is definitely as much a beneficiary of that service.
So maybe two people are being served in that, or at least two.
Symbiotic.
I like a little about what Gail was saying, because I'm thinking of Eric Pochet from Zen Hospice talked about the idea of listening to what's present and then responding. Because sometimes we come into a situation and we think we know what needs to be done. And sometimes it's the presence and the listening to see what's needed and then responding. Because sometimes it's, nothing needs to be done other than be present. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we get caught up in wanting to act or wanting to do, and nothing needs to be done other than to be present.
So I came up with a kind of a, and I didn't see this written anywhere, but you know, if I searched my heart, what would be the Dharma perspective on service? What is the how is service presented in the teachings? And I see it as wisdom and compassion in action. You know, we need both parts, both our caring and concern, but also what you're just saying, Lori, about really listening and seeing what's appropriate in that situation. You know, and being really careful and about projecting our values and our ideas into someone else's situation. So what types, I'm interested in hearing what types of service you all have done, or what you think of as service in your lives, or what you've experienced as, you know, maybe both the service you've done or the service you've received.
I teach down at the library, computer classes, and also usher at the Gallo Center for the Arts here in town for a while. Then singing, I love to sing, so I sing the chorus, but that's not really, that's a different kind of service. That's not even qualified as what we're talking about.
Thank you.
I've been a volunteer for hospice in the past, a volunteer for Red Cross, particularly during the time of Katrina, and talking with people coming back and going to help in New Orleans. I'm a clinical social worker. I've been present for folks when they're passing, my own family members. Friends, I worked in a school where lots of schools where there was a child who was killed by his own father, not knowing that the child was behind his van when he dropped the kid off from school. The kid was about five, and they were spoke different language and Vietnamese. And when I think of service, that incident comes to my mind more than any other, really, because I was with the family practically 24 hours. I didn't speak the language and no translator. I knew the family was in pain, and what I offered was being there and comforting them, crying with them, and just being a part of their suffering at that time, but not. My suffering was more controlled because I was there for them, so I didn't need anyone to take care of me. I needed to be there to be with them. and to ultimately find other services for them. And that's what I feel about being able to serve and not having an attachment for something for oneself, but giving or being present for the need, and whatever happens with that happens. It's not contrived. It's not set up to be any way other than the way it is. And, you know, being at family members' bedsides and friends' bedsides in the past, and being able to be there with an open heart, and also looking at other needs the family might need. If they need water, if they need, you know, a break from being at the bedside, or if there's a particular time they need to be in the room and they're not, then to get them. And being a counselor, a therapist, working with children and adults.
Thank you.
I've taught at the Literacy Center, adults reading, and volunteer in classroom. I'm a retired teacher, so I like working with kids and staying in touch with that kind of thing. Also at the Wildlife Care Center, feeding, and the birds are falling out of the sky, but feeding the baby birds and getting them back so they can be released and back to their natural habitat.
That's great.
I'm more involved in like a lot of political activism and social justice movement work, advocacy for youth, in particular gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender community. And know for sure there's some ego attachment involved in the service I do. I think I get very motivated by anger a lot of times at injustice. I like to kind of approach it from a more peaceful place.
Mm-hmm. That's great. It's good that you see that.
Yeah.
Thank you. What about everyday acts of service in this regard? Strangers or family members?
I was going to say that I was struggling for a long time because I really wanted to do something on more of a larger level of service, but I have a 2-year-old and a 4-year-old, so I'm a stay-at-home mom with them, and so I feel very pressed for time to even brush my teeth, and so I have these grand dreams of, you know, whatever, working for this organization or that organization, but it's not realistic right now, and recently I was trying to be more aware of how I could just be of service just with the life that I've got. And I realized, or I'm realizing, that the opportunity is all over the place. So, like, for example, and a lady came for life insurance to my home yesterday, and then I've been trying really hard just to listen to people and, like, look at them in the face. And so I'm thinking I can help this person just by noticing that they exist, really looking at them. And I've been trying to do that. And so she came to my house, and I was, like, just looking at her. She started just telling me all about how her sister's baby died. And all, it was this really interesting thing. And I was just, okay, and I was just listening. And then she was crying, and then she was better. And mm-hmm. I was like, what just happened, you know? But she really needed to talk to somebody, you know? And I've noticed the more I listen to people and just look at them, really look at them in the face, and whoever, you know, I go to a mom's club thing, and you know, I really just look at them. I don't stare at them, but you know, I like really like acknowledge their existence, and they just start talking, and people just need to be seen and heard, and mostly they just want to be seen and heard, you know. And I've noticed that when that happens and they open up to me, even though I don't really do anything or say anything, or maybe whatever they need in that moment, like a hug or a smile or something, but I feel better. And it's not even my problem, you know, when they seem to feel better as well. But so I'm feeling like right now I'm trying to approach just kind of even going to the grocery store. I work 1 hour a week on Fridays, and I have this goal of like teaching math to parents, but in what I've been finding more is that when I just like look at them and listen to them, there's so much more to this 1 hour little class I do with these parents because they want to talk about some, I don't know, it's just interesting. Mm-hmm. So that's been helping me because I was feeling like I needed to do a big service, like I want to help. So I felt like I had to join an organization and help. But when I looked at it like this, then I feel like it's very satisfying as well.
Mm-hmm.
In a similar way, or a different way. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
I love to let people merge into my lane in traffic. It's my favorite thing to do. I hold the space for you. Because I relate to your road raging comment. And to you, seeing people as real. I was stuck in East Bay traffic yesterday, and I looked at every person I passed.
Right.
I'm like, you're not an obstacle. We're all going the same place. And clearly we're stopped because there's an accident, and that's horrible. So you know, may you be well, and may you be well.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Find a place, and may you be well. Because...
Right.
And it really seems to help. I mean, for me at least, when I don't know. And I think I don't know.
How do you serve yourself?
Here we are.
So dharma practice, maybe meditation,
music, being involved in
saying
no, being okay with that. Mm-hmm. I'm just one person.
Could you say more about that? That's interesting.
I think for a lot of the work that I've done, I felt that if I don't do it, nobody will, and so I've learned that I'm human with limits, and so I can't overextend myself or that I'm no good to me.
Yeah.
So I meditate daily and do yoga and try to treat myself the way I'm treating other people, you know. I try. By no means, you know.
Well, that's all we can do.
That's why they call it a practice.
Thank you.
I garden. I love my dog. I love my partner. I read. I meditate. I like music. I like listening to music. I like poetry. So I try to give as much as I can to myself.
Thank you.
I'm kind of busy at beginning a new part of my life of serving. I teach mindfulness-based stress reduction, and one of the parts of my life that I don't want to fade in the background is I'm a grandmother and I have three grandchildren, and I know that both my sons are and their wives are very busy with their jobs and raising little ones and being really busy. It's very stressful. And so I try to reach out and help whenever I can to give them a break. But it also, being around children, you know, I get a lot from it myself. And so just being there, you know, for my family.
Thank you.
It's true for us too. We have five grandkids, and two in the Bay Area, two in LA, one in Tokyo, but we don't see very often. But my wife and I are both retired teachers and love to spend time with them. In fact, there are two from the Bay Area coming over today for the weekend. One down in the office tonight to see flying comets, that kind of thing. So we love to do that and exercise together and eat healthy and take care of each other, my wife and I. Our family, as well as give as much as we can to the community without overdoing it.
That's great.
Try to find out.
Yeah, it seems we have parents and teachers and grandparents here, and it seems like service towards the young, you know, to create an investment in the future is really valuable. I don't know how much it's valued in our society, you know, but at least not in terms of the budget for schools, but I don't go into that. But yeah, so it's really nice to, you know, hear how much that's a part of, you know, everyday service for people. Did you have another?
Sorry. I was going to say another thing that I've done for myself that's been probably the biggest help is when I lay in bed at night and then I go to sleep, or I try to go to sleep, and is whatever is pressing on my mind, if I made some error in the day or I was unskillful somewhere and it's coming back to me, is I now forgive myself and just say I start again tomorrow with that, you know. And that is a huge service to myself because it gives me sleep and like a restful mind and a peaceful heart. And so I think just self-forgiveness is like the best service to myself, because I know you can just like let go of that and you're like, okay, I just try again, you know. Maybe I did or didn't do my best, but I can do my best again tomorrow, you know, and start again. It's like the mindfulness and bringing yourself back, you know, gently and kindly. Oops on that one. Mm-hmm. Paid attention, and now next time I'll do my best to be better. And so that serves me very well.
I'm glad you said that. Yeah, I think especially with the loving kindness, a lot of people have trouble doing it because there's this accountancy of all of the mistakes we've made that we haven't been able to forgive. I know this was really hard for me, and then when I could really tune into that, and there are some in Sharon's book and other places, some forgiveness practices, they're just like that. They're phrases where you connect with the heart feeling. So either formal or informal self-forgiveness, I think, is really essential, you know, as part of the path.
Erin, thank you for your comment, because I do, before I go to bed, I always, and it really seems to help, that would be a good complement to what I do, which is gratitude. What am I thankful for? Who and for what am I thankful for today? And I get, if anything, I kind of, I'm careful, I got to be, because I get really so happy. But then I can turn it around and do what you do and calm it down by saying, and where did I, how can I learn from my mistakes today? What did I do that I can learn from that I don't do again? So it would be a nice compliment. So thank you.
Yes. I'm a hospice volunteer, but my greatest joy and service, I think, for my grandkids and my family.
Which are my kids?
Oh. Wonderful.
It never feels like a job. It always feels like something I can do and hopefully do well. But I get a lot from it, I have to say.
Thank you. So that's great. I had just kind of thought, well, what are the different types of service? And I think we got onto many of them. You know, certainly there's community service. There's a lot of organizations. We're going to have a slideshow this afternoon for about a half an hour looking at some Buddhist organizations that are doing service, which I'm heartened to see, because historically there's been a lot of other religions doing service in a formal way. I mean, I think, you know, at the heart of Dharma practice is a type of service and an awareness, but they've really been missing from the table of the big groups, the humanitarian aid and political action and things like that. And we're starting to see that, at least in this country. And it's a little different in Asia, but so practicing meditation, giving dana can be a form. Environmental activism, or just being a good steward of the planet, you know, not using more than we need, being careful with where we dispose of things. I think animals, there was some talk of animals today, you know, they really get the short shrift in our world in so many ways. So, you know, kindness to animals or awareness of animal rights, I guess, is what we call it formally. Bending over to pick something up that someone dropped, you know, it's kind of interesting to see, watch the mind in that whole process, you know, and all of the associations that go on. But sometimes that can be a smile. You know, you talked about listening and nearly being a witness. I wanted to kind of shift gears a little bit here and talk about some of history's, some historical examples of where service has gone awry. And I'm sure you can all think of that, where people have started off maybe with some good intentions of service, and you know, maybe you'll find some familiarity in this. I certainly have. This is just kind of a list off the top of my head. And, you know, kind of one thing we talked about earlier is projecting one's own values on a situation, you know, going into it with prejudgments. And, you know, one big area that this has happened historically is the Western model of economic development, you know, bringing that to developing nations. And, you know, we might bring in non-indigenous seeds and fertilizer and heavy farming and you know, and there can be around that an expectation that this country will develop and they'll become a trade partner with us, or there may be debt for that type of service, and then an expectation is built there. Giving food aid to certain areas that has not very nutritious value, or, you know, maybe it's Western food aid or different from the indigenous diet, so the problems like diabetes and obesity and hypertension can develop. Giving medicines that are harmful or inappropriate or out of date. This has happened. And WHO, who, you know, is kind of one of the watchdog humanitarian aid organizations, really has really banned out of date medications, you know, for various groups like Doctors Without Borders and other groups. One thing, in giving service, and this can be on an individual level or an organizational level, like the last examples, but creating a dependency, you know, where that service is then expected, and there's a non-mutuality, there's a dependency created, or that relationship, that service is unsustainable when, you know, that was kind of not really looked at the beginning, that you know, that type of service was meant to help that person or that group or that nation or whatever find their own way, develop, you know, get what they need, but not to become like a, you know, a vassal state or, you know, a dependent. Along that line, make promises that can't be kept, you know, certainly when humanitarian groups go into areas, they need to really be careful of what they're saying they can do and be realistic with themselves. There can be aid can be used, or service can be used, like maybe to discriminate or to, you know, reward a certain group or person and punish others. You know, they're the recipient of my attention or this organization's resources. Another example would be environmental cleanup that actually causes more harm, you know, that displaces a population, a species, or that isn't, you know, done in a really thought out, scientifically backed up way. And we can look at ways where people are actually exploited and under the guise of service, you know, that there have been organizations that have gone in to, let's say, developing nations, and they really saw that as an opportunity, you know, to, whether that's to misuse the donations given to that organization, or to somehow make money, profit, or some other form of abuse from the recipients of the aid. We have wars and military campaigns. That's a form of service. You know, sometimes we justify going into some place and liberating them from a despot or you know, a tyranny. And I'm not really, I mean, what I'm talking about, you know, kind of sounds judgmental, and I don't understand all of the complexities of certainly the wars that we're involved in. But I'm just saying, from the outside, that looks like there's a lot going on here, and there's a lot that's being not accounted for, like the assumptions. And then we look at religious crusades and missions. You know, that's another example of, I think, in the people providing that service, of really thinking that they were doing something important, of value, and essential, maybe even life-saving, to the people who were recipients of that. The missions. Um, So that's, and then kind of to put a personal face on it, you know, my I don't want to go too much into my story because it's not as important as what we all have to say together, but I started out as, you know, a kind of an angry young man wanting to change the injustice of the world, and I went into medicine. And, you know, it's just a machine, at least where I went to medical school and residency. You just, you know, it's all about the technology and processing people and not feeling that real connection to, you know, to, you know, the positive part is to, you know, try and help people and treat illness. And, you know, so there's the core of wanting to help, but it's done in a lot of unskillful ways, and, you know, just working the long hours of residency and all that really, you know, kind of lost it along the way. And, you know, there were situations where I, you know, patient would be talking to me, for example, and I would just be, you know, kind of screaming at them in my head. And sometimes in reality, you know, having such unkind thoughts that just wishing someone would just go ahead and die, so I wouldn't have to, they wouldn't be on my service anymore when I was a young resident and the service was just really large and, you know, there's someone, you know, and just being really confused about my role and, you know, still having this heart of wanting to be of service and to have compassion, but to be so jaded by, you know, the life experience. And, you know, when I came to Dharma practice and started meditating, I finally got to sit down and really, you know, start to take apart this, you know, to see what was going on in my mind and all of the tensions that had built up in the body and the, you know, just the unskillfulness. You know, I think Dharma practice, if nothing else, brings us to look at our behavior and reflect at the end of the day or, you know, in a moment's notice what we've done and how we've created more suffering in the world. And that's really, you know, a choice we have. Can we create more suffering or can we work to counteract it? So it's been a really rewarding experience for me. And when I work in the emergency room, it's, you know, it's probably a place similar to this one right next door here. It's a hustle and bustle. It's an urban trauma center in the middle of Sacramento. And, you know, it's just such a study, such a home, a divine abode of suffering. I mean, everyone is suffering there on so many different levels. People come in pain. There's a lot of fear. You know, what's going to happen? Am I going to get bad news? Am I going to wait for hours? Is it going to hurt, whatever they're going to do for me? How much does it cost if I don't have insurance or if I have a copay? You know, how is that? You know, there's, I heard some statistic, like there's 1 million people who go bankrupt in this country a year based on health, not being able to afford health, or, you know, racking up a big health bill and not being able to pay for it. I don't know if that's true or not, but, you know, it's not hard to imagine, given our situation. So there's that, and there's, you know, people who are just, you know, really lost in addictions. There's people who come in with complex stories on, you know, to get pain medication. There's people who live with pain every day of their life, and they come to a place like that, and they're treated like, you know, less than human, or treated, you know, with a lot of judgments, and maybe not given relief for their pain due to those judgments. There are people who are dying who come to the emergency room. They know they're dying. Sometimes they don't. But sometimes they do, and that's their last, you know, that's where they're going to spend their last moments, is in this modern mechanized marvel that we've created. And then there's the staff, you know, there's people like me who get, you know, lost along the way, they get burnt out, and they act out their, you know, their defilements, and they come out in their interactions, and they suffer so much too, you know, I suffer. So it's a real ripe area to look at service and insight, meditation, mindfulness, compassion, loving kindness. And to really, what I find is that it's easy, you know, as things pick up and I feel overwhelmed and I just, you know, I just need some space, but I can't take that space because somebody, you know, really needs that attention, that sometimes all I can do is like maybe feel my feet on the floor or just, you know, take a big sigh, you know, and just that just that moment of connecting again with my body and just being in that moment can be very helpful. And, you know, I certainly like to reflect at the end of my shift, at the end of the day, of, you know, where I succeeded, you know, what worked and how, you know, not to be, like, totally self-congratulatory, but just to say, yeah, I really have this pattern and I didn't do that pattern today. Mm-hmm. And then to say, or if I did, you know, if I did fall into that same trap, to say, okay, you know, I'm not going to beat myself up over this. I really want to try to not, you know, say that quick rejoinder, that quick quip back to, you know, the nurse who's been, you know, hounding me, or, you know, the patient who, you know, starts yelling at me. But to, you know, just to be, to change, to, you know, to use the practice to change. So in our, I'm going to try and wrap this up in a moment. In our efforts to work with service, to be of true service, to take the Dharma practice out into the world, the most important thing, I heard it earlier today, was is our intentions. You know, our the word we'd use was motivations. But, you know, for every thing we do, whether we think something, speak something, or do something physically, an intention precedes that. Most of the time, we're not aware of that intention. That intention is—it's subconscious. It's a part of our habitual nature, our—you know—how we've developed. So we act out of that core, and sometimes it's skillful, sometimes it's not. So the Dharma practice, the real goal is to look at that intention and to set the intention to increase our skillfulness and decrease our unskillfulness, and, you know, to look at the I mentioned earlier the three root defilements are greed, hatred, and delusion. To look and see, are our intentions based in that, in one of those, or a combination of those, or are they based in their opposites, which is a generosity, loving kindness, and wisdom. And to really, before we even act or think about acting, to really see if we can bring that into our awareness. You know, what is my intention? It's so important with service. You know, if we just reach down and pick up a pen that someone dropped, or give them a smile, it, you know, it's kind of hard to set that. But if we're going to get involved, you know, let's say there's a family member who's suffering and we want to have a conversation with them, or we want to join a service organization, or, you know, do a volunteer job, it's so important to really look at the motives. And what I've found a lot of times is my motives are mixed. You know, there's, you know, one of my favorite ones is to hide an unskillful motive underneath a skillful one. You know, and historically for me, what that's looked like is doing service for another, but wanting to get the attention, you know, to kind of boost up my ego, to be recognized. And that, you know, and there's nothing wrong with being recognized per se, but when that becomes the real hit, the, you know, the kind of the what's needed in the situation, it's a form of clinging that results in suffering, and it also results in, oftentimes, it has for me, in unskillful behaviors that, you know, cause other people to suffer too. So it's a little bit more over the scope of today's day long, but really, I think service needs to be done in the context of the and the Dharma of the Noble Eightfold Path. You know, to really, for me, that's what Dharma practice. You know, I've used that term today, but really, you know, it's not just meditating once a day, but it's really to take on the teachings and engage them. You know, and to look at the Eightfold Path right view. You know, to understand what's really happening, having the right intention. Right action, right speech, livelihood, right effort, mindfulness, and concentration. So I'm not going to go into each one of those individually. I know you teach them here, Lori, and a lot of you have been practicing these for more years than I have been. But it's really, I think, essential to be, for me to be skillful, that this is a system that works really well, and it's a progressive system that over time I've developed faith in, you know, that I've seen it work in my life and other life so well. There was mention earlier of generosity, you know, and I think that's at the base of service. You know, and this is what the Buddha taught, you know, to people who are just coming in for the first time, you know, lay people or people who wanted to check them out to maybe ordain as a monk or a nun, the first thing we would teach them is to be generous, you know, and whether that's with our attention, with you know, resources, or, you know, in whatever way. And I think that's at the heart of service, is that generosity. The five precepts, this is under right action, I think are really an owner's manual or a user's guide for being of service, because the meditation's important, the intentions are important, mindfulness is certainly important, but if we can have a framework to guide our actions, our external actions, that can be a tremendous help. And so I think that's, you know, really an essential part. And I'll just say the five precepts for those who, you know, may be new to the practice or want a reminder. The first one is, and these are all training precepts, they're not like Ten Commandments or, you know, absolute rules, but it's just an invitation to look at suffering and what creates suffering and what alleviates it. So the first one is refraining from killing living beings or harming them. And that's stated in the negative. To state in the positive, it's to be a benefit to others and to oneself. The second one is to refrain from taking that which is not freely given, and to refrain from stealing. And to state in the positive, that's to be just aware of other people's possessions and how we, you know, not take them for granted, and to also maybe to be generous with our own resources. The third one is to refrain from sexual harm, from sexual misconduct, and that just points to the fact that our sexual intimacy is such a area of intimacy, and that is very delicate, and a lot of people can be harmed from it, and that we need to, you know, really look at what our intentions there and how we behave. The fourth one is refraining from harmful speech. That's obviously very important. We've all put our foot in our mouths, and you know, harmful speech is defined as speech that is not true. That's maybe harsh speech, speech that's divisive or that creates enmity between people, oneself and others or other groups, or just idle chatter, you know, just kind of blathering for no good benefit. And then the final one is to refrain from intoxicants that create heedlessness. And this is to say that, you know, there's no Buddhist injunction against having a glass of wine, but just to be aware of and look at, you know, what we put into our bodies, you know, whether that's food or drink or maybe it's media, and then what the effect that has on our bodies and minds. And, you know, if we're trying to wake up and have more wisdom, you know, if we create this, you know, create more delusion in our existence, it's, you know, what the consequences are going to be. So those are the five precepts. And then the last thing about working with service, and then I think we'll break for lunch, is that to really in service, so we set the intention to be skillful, and we want to use our mindfulness practice. Really, this is the heart of actually doing the work, is to be mindful of what's going on. And we teach the four foundations of mindfulness here, to really have a sense of, one, what's going on in the body, and part of the body is the breath. What is the vedana, or the feeling tones, whether that's pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. There's this quality to all of our experience of immediate arising of something that's pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. That's the second. The third one is the mind, what's going on with our thoughts and our emotions, being mindful of that in the moment. And then the last one is the dhammas, and this is kind of the framework of Dharma teaching, and that's looking at particular categories. That we have the five hindrances, the five aggregates, the seven awakening factors, the six sense bases, and the four noble truths. A lot of lists, which I know a lot of you know, but those are just categories of skillful and unskillful states, and it's a helpful mnemonic, really, to look at this, how we suffer and how we get free from it, and, you know, so again, beyond the scope of what we're talking about here in service, but being mindful, for example, if there's a lot of aversion coming up, you're having a conversation with somebody you want to maybe give service to or to be with in some way, and there's a lot of aversion, to say, oh, there is the hindrance of aversion that has arisen in me, you know, that, just on that simple level. And what does that feel like in the body? Feeling tone oftentimes is unpleasant. And just to kind of keep coming back to connecting those, what's happening in my breath? And that's really the practice of mindfulness in any situation, and certainly with service. So that was a lot of talking on my part. Before we break, are there any comments anyone wants to make, or questions, or needs at this point? We'll have a lot more opportunity. The afternoon will be more, we have a slideshow, but the last discussion section will be more interactive, and we'll have a lot of time to share our stories and think about this service, talk about it. Okay, so is it time for lunch?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, it's time for lunch. Thank you for your kind attention.